LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
This is an emergency broadcast from the BBC. Information of a possible nuclear strike against this country has been received. The current threat level is critical, meaning an attack is imminent. Civilians are advised to stay in their homes. Evacuations are currently taking place in the London area. All motorways and airports have been closed for military use. Non-essential telephone lines have also been temporarily disconnected. Please stand by and await further information. This is an emergency broadcast from the BBC. Information of a possible nuclear strike against...
Attack warning red. Attack warning red. Seek immediate shelter. Seek immediate shelter. Attack warning red. Attack warning red.
Is BBC Television from London. Normal programming has been suspended.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Randy Powers, who joins us to discuss disaster preparedness and some of the mounting threats to stability in society. Although most of us like to believe that disaster will never hit us where it hurts, time and time again, individuals, families, and entire communities are caught out when it does. From floods to wildfires, from hurricanes to earthquakes, basic preparedness for disruption to our daily lives is relatively simple and need not be expensive. And yet, when catastrophe comes calling, millions worldwide continue to rely on government riding to the rescue and on state assistance, which all too often fails with fatal results. Hollywood movies favour doomsday scenarios such as meteor strikes, nuclear wars, and the ever-popular plagues of zombie apocalypse, but everyday disasters are likely to be localised and much more mundane. They are also much more likely to actually occur. In a world of political, economic and social upheaval, environmental destruction, climate chaos, and rampant resource conflicts, only the foolhardy or insane would insist it can't happen here. The good news is that with a little time, study, and forward planning, almost anyone, anywhere, can begin to take a few basic steps to help ensure that they, their loved ones, and their community ride out the coming storms, whenever and wherever they strike.
Hello and welcome, Randy, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Hello, Greg. It's so nice to talk to you again, my friend.
It's been, I don't quite know how long, Randy, but it's been quite some time since you and Steve Conculli were on. I very much enjoyed the show then. You and I today are going to tackle some of the same areas, but of course, events in the world have moved on apace. Some of the issues are the same, some are worse, some are better from our point of view. Before we get started though, just for listeners who don't know, tell them a little bit about yourself and your work and how you came to be interested in preparedness.
Well, I grew up very rural, and then around 20 years old, I found myself in a bustling city here in Georgia, Atlanta, which is the state capital. And for the next 5 or 6 years, I was pretty much just living the city life, and I didn't think about it very much. But once we decided to buy our home and move back out of the city, back out to a more rural setting, yeah, all those things that I had done as a child came rushing back to me. And I knew I wanted to get back involved with just being more self-sufficient in general. I wanted to have a garden. I wanted to make sure that our property was actually working for us rather than us just paying for it. So with that as the baseline, I took a look at world events, some of which had started prior to our move out, like September the 11th here in the United States. And, of course, everybody remembers the Y2K thing. And neither of those things were the direct spur for me to get back into preparedness. But it was actually more just the fact that I noticed these things were still ongoing. But now I was a married man, and I had a genuine interest in those things that I mentioned before to begin with, and it all just sort of dovetailed itself back together. And then around 2008, when the financial crisis struck, we really got serious about it and started to make sure that if things were to go sideways for us, we would still be okay. And we were able to navigate that period of time pretty well without much of a direct impact on our family. And we were able to sit back and just observe what was happening. And that was a very unique position because we could feel the stress and the anger and the fear that was around virtually every corner here in the States during that period of time. And being able to sit back from it and not actually be directly affected, it gave us a broader view on it. So we were able to sort of dissect what was happening and why it happened. But we learned lessons along the way. Just because we weren't directly impacted in 2008, we were still making mistakes along the road of being more prepared. And every mistake we made, we learned something. And it was around 2012. And of course, around that time, you had all the talk about the Mayans and things like that, which I find to be a very interesting discussion point. Like, it was great to learn about the history of those civilizations and things, but I was never concerned about the end of days or anything like that. But it was around that time, though, I saw that so many other people started thinking about, wow, what if this happened? What would I do? And all of this stuff kind of came together and said, well, Alice and I were talking, and I said, well, we made a lot of mistakes. If these other people are genuinely interested in those, what it would take to be prepared, what if we could help them not make the same mistakes we made? And that led me to starting a very small consulting company called Practical Tactical, which is just what it says. We try to take a practical approach to giving ourselves an advantage should a bad situation ever arise. And from there, things have just kind of blossomed. So now I have there's the website, and I've been asked very graciously to consult on a couple of different books, television series, and things like that. So it's been a whole lot of fun. I still enjoy doing it all the time, and I'm just, excited to see where it goes. But with everything that's going on in the world today, I certainly don't have a short list of things that will keep me motivated to staying prepared, that's for sure.
Certainly not. No, I'm going to walk through some of those things going on in the world, as you put it, some of those concerns, as we move through the show and address those. Now, at the start, I mentioned that I had set out in my introduction, a basic idea of, what preparedness is in this context for people who are not familiar with it. Some people might think they're familiar with it and they say, you mean survivalism. But perhaps we should say something at this point about what preparedness is from your perspective, as opposed to perhaps people's cliched ideas of survivalism, which is essentially your guys, the cliched image, I'm not wanting to offend anyone here, but sort of white redneck guys in the mountains, guns and beans, and a shack, or maybe they've spent a lot more money and they've got a bunker of some kind, and they're holed up there, and there's a lot of paranoia involved And some of these people have been in this situation for a long time, almost willing disaster to come. And there's a ideological and political element there to that, to a lot of that scene anyway. So just help us characterize what we're talking about here, what the differences are.
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think, especially when you talk in terms of ideological and maybe even political viewpoints that sort of shape people's views of the world, and that's fine. My position has always been that the idea of preparedness is very much like what the Boy Scouts talk about here in the States, which is just always be ready, always prepared, semper paratus, as it were. And I have just bought into that completely, and that is in no way to dismiss or diminish any efforts by anyone's interests in survivalism and the woodcraft and things like that that it takes to survive on your own. But I'm a fan of all those things. I just think that there's so much more to it than that. But and if you're active and out the way we are, there's a chance I could end up sliding down a ravine somewhere and breaking a leg or just getting lost, and now I have to survive. So there's a place in my toolkit for those skills, and we do think about those things and practice those skills, but I have never considered myself a survivalist. And instead, we have turned more towards the preparedness as a lifestyle angle. And what I mean by that is, you here in the States, the general mode of living is suburban living, you live in the city. You know, that's pretty much, and you have people who live out in the country. So there's three different ways. But the majority of people, it seems, live in or around a city or work in a city. And so we're not going to be falling down any ravines or anything, you know, too many days. So I decided to take a look at the things that impact people who live those kind of lifestyles in and around the cities, and what can, the basic things you can do just to make sure that when things go wrong, which they will, especially here in the United States with our aging infrastructure, and we are a continental country. So depending on which part of the country you look at, you have a different natural disaster that you should be aware of and prepare for. And those things are going to happen, so you may as well be ready. And again, it could be a water main break out front of your subdivided neighborhood that cuts off the entire subdivision for a couple of weeks from having fresh water. Do you have a way to manage that already? Or would you really be in a lurch and not able to, you know, bathe daily or cook your food or do whatever it is? It's things like that that we really try to focus on, just a preparedness lifestyle that will address the everyday issues that we all face. And beyond that, taking it one step further, I'm big on preparing for your personal situation and what best suits you. So if you live in the heart of the city, and I work in, have worked in, and travel through major cities very often, if you live in one of those places, you very well can't have an acre-sized garden, you know, outside of your condominium. It just doesn't work that way. But that doesn't mean that you can't take steps to build up a 2-week to a 1-month supply of food just in case something were to happen and you needed to stay indoors because you had a severe weather event. Or if you live on the 15th floor of your building and the electric is out for a week, well, if it's a citywide blackout, water won't be pumped up to that 15th floor. So do you have a plan for water? Or do you have a water source nearby that you trust that you could purify, even if you don't have room to store water? So any issue that you want to think about, there's a tiered approach to how to solve that problem. And in our situation, as I said, we moved back out rural, more rural than in the city, so we are able to have a garden and things like that. And at that point, it just becomes sort of along the permaculture line and the homesteading line. It becomes more about making your property work for you as a real investment, as opposed to just another note that you have to pay. So And I guess on a more personal level, I can say without a doubt that living this lifestyle as opposed to treating it as a fad or just as a hobby gives us the opportunity to truly benefit in the more personal ways. So it gives us a chance to teach skills to our children and our young our friends who have young children. We can teach these skills to them, get them outside and keep them happy, and it just opens a new world to them. And whether they realize it or not, they're learning to be resilient from a young age, and those are things that hopefully they'll keep with them forever. So I'm pretty happy with the entire situation. And that it is not, again, survivalism is in the toolkit. And if you visit my website and watch my videos, you'll hear me reference those things. Do you know how to make a fire? Do you know how to pack a bag? And those sorts of things. But that's not the primary focus for us.
Yeah, well, there was a couple of key things you mentioned there, which I'm going to expand on as we work through. One of which was the idea of using what you've got and where you are. This is by no means just for country folks or even people with country skills or even people who visit the country. This can be for people who like the city, they live in the city and they never leave. And the other idea is that this is as a lifestyle as opposed to something that you maybe do a course on, buy a book on, and then it gets put on the shelf and forgotten, you know, because the idea here is that some of the threats to our, you know, livelihoods and families and well-being are going to be ongoing. They're not going away. So this, you know, we're talking about making changes here for life, but we can come to that in detail. So folks are interested, they should stay with us. Before we get to some of those points, I just want to ask you, like, straight away about your new radio show that you've started doing, because this is one of the main developments in your operation since the last time I spoke to you. So tell us about that. You know, how did that come about, and what's really the aim or the central kind of goal behind that?
Well, I really have to give my friend Stephen Conkley a nice shout out here, because as I mentioned in the beginning, I've had the opportunity to serve as a consultant, and he had a wildly popular book series called the Perseid Collapse series, and it wound up being four total books. And he reached out to me just to make certain that he was on board. He had everything in line as far as the preparedness side goes. And I told him, look, I'm no expert. I know what I know through trial and experience. He said, that's fine. That's what I'm looking for. And so I was more than happy to help him work on that series. And essentially, that led to us writing Practical Prepping, No Apocalypse Required, which was a co-authored book that was originally supposed to be just sort of an addendum or an accomplice to run alongside the Perseid Collapse series, just to sort of flesh out exactly what the Fletcher family were doing and why they were doing it. But as we started discussing it, that book grew into, or that side book grew into a full book. I think we wound up with something like 24 chapters in the book, and we go into everything that we may or may not get into today in that book. So if you're interested in a deep dive on it, that's where I would point you, is to that book. Well, that opportunity led us to doing promotion for that book, and we were able to do a couple of podcasts where we discussed the book in depth. And from that, one of the executive producers, or the executive producer for the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, reached out to me and asked if I had an interest in doing a preparedness show. And I did. It took me a minute to get my ducks in a row to where I could actually focus on it and do it the way I wanted to do it. But they've been wonderful as far as giving me free rein about what I want to discuss on the show. And my goal is to focus on the things, like I said just a minute ago, the things that can hopefully drive the point home to people that preparedness does not have to be a zero-sum game. It doesn't have to be, it's either me or it's you. It doesn't have to be, you have a bunker and 100 acres or you just can't do it. There is vast ground in the middle there that can be trod. And that brings me back to one of our core philosophies, which is what is right for your situation? What are your goals, you know? And the living the lifestyle portion of that comes from the fact that I would hope that the people weren't being prepared out of fear, because coming from a place of fear is never a good thing, in my opinion and in my experience. But if you can do it because you have a passion about it, then you're going to make more progress. And hopefully that will come through in the show. And we will have people who are specifically talking about the various parts of preparedness. In our first show, I was fortunate enough to have a very popular speaker in the preparedness world by the name of Survivor Jane come on the show and talk about preparedness for women and why it makes sense to be prepared if you're a woman. But because of her style, that crosses over and her audience is much larger than just women. And she lives the lifestyle too, so that was the perfect place to start the series. And we also are going to have people on that are going to take the longer range viewpoint. So, for instance, I'm going to have people like James Howard Kunstler, and my friend Stephen Conkley is going to come on, Gil Treverberg, and Alice Friedman, Robert Rapier. These kind of people who can help us look into the future, and not even look into the future, but look around our world today, see the bigger picture, and offer that. You know, there's a lot going on, and the more you understand about what's happening in your world now, the better off you'll be when it comes to making decisions about your personal preparedness. There's plenty to get you motivated. So it just all starts with understanding and education. So I hope that we can both address the acute functions of preparedness, the actions, the immediate action steps you can take to do it. But also, I want to open people up to some of the larger forces that are going on out there in the world. I really think that it's going to be a very interesting discussion that we're going to have going forward, and I really hope people will tune in and give us a listen.
Okay, well, the Chris, the threats that that we have been talking about and will be talking about are kind of many and varied. Some of them, such as natural disasters, are just so-called acts of God. Still something to be, that you can be prepared for up to a point as best you can. And then we have all manner of threats that stem from our ways of life and how our societies are constructed or otherwise. And one interesting wrinkle that we can fold into this in terms of world events as they are right now, I mean, I recently... I follow the political scene more or less worldwide, but with particular attention to here in the UK, the US, of course, because it's so important globally, and also the EU, the European Union, which takes in most of the major European countries that US listeners will be familiar with. And I recently did a show about the UK vote to leave the European Union. Now, whether this actually ever happens or not, and all the ins and outs and Machiavellian cloak and dagger around that is kind of neither here nor there, but from our point of view and in your context, there are things that would make your ears prick up and go, okay, well, depending on how this pans out, this could be relevant to my readers, my listeners, you know, your readers, your listeners, whatever it happens to be. And of course, now that that's, for the moment at least, the Brexit thing is in the past as far as the actual big, you know, brouhaha about the vote, we now are watching, of course, the US current presidential election cycle playing out, and no doubt you're following this closely on whatever level, thinking maybe ways that most people are not thinking, okay, well, depending on who's going to be the next president, what could that mean for the issues that I follow closely and the things that I'm passionate about? So give us some of your thoughts there and why you think these could be impactful in your world.
Well, if I could, I'd like to say just a quick word about the Brexit, because, I mean, that was high drama. If you follow politics the way you described, and of course I do, that was the kind of thing that was just, it was fascinating to watch, especially in the days after, because you would hear people say things like, well, I never actually expected it to happen. You know, I voted this way just because, which just boggles my mind. Like, that's what a vote is.
Yeah, that's how it works.
Right. I just could not understand that. But, and I don't proclaim to understand the inner workings of the UK and things like that, but I mean, when you watch the coverage here in the States, of course, based on our history and our immediate history, the backlash that came after the result of the Brexit, as far as racially motivated or hate speech, things like that, acts, I don't know if they were as severe as maybe it was portrayed to us here in the States, but it certainly seemed as though there was a backlash there. And, of course, that's never good. But that is exactly the kind of thing. Now, I notice I haven't even gotten to the impacts of breaking up the EU and whether or not globalism or nationalism or whatever is a good thing. But just the idea that a single vote could bring forth those types of impacts immediately afterwards, sort of, and I'm not trying to take sides here, but again, this is just how I saw it, looking at the coverage. It just looked like the results of the vote gave people who won the vote the license to then be more aggressive in their viewpoints. And some of that turned out to be not just verbal, you know, there were some physical altercations in there. And that's actually the kind of thing that my sort of preparedness is looking at, because, you know, none of us live in a vacuum. We're all impacted by world events like that and the people who lead those pushes, you know. And I was just blown away when the leaders of the Brexit movement then just seemed to up and resign and go, okay, I'm done. You know, I have fun with this. Whatever happens, I did my part. And as a citizen, you're just sort of along for the ride. But by living a lifestyle of preparedness in many ways, not totally, but in many ways, and by living a life of preparedness, I guess it's an attempt to sort of wrestle back control over the things that you actually can control. And one of those things is, okay, let's just say the Brexit vote happens, they vote to leave, which is exactly what happened. Well, I'm looking at the numbers here, and it tells me that, what in the world was it? Let's see, the Brexit vote, I had a nice note here, and I'm trying to find it. It just, after Britain's vote to leave, it has impacted things like Deutsche Bank, right, whose numbers are down 18% since the vote. And Deutsche Bank is one of the most highly leveraged banks in the world economy. So if Deutsche Bank has serious dislocations, then that will absolutely impact us here in the States. So, I mean, the ripple effect from a move like that, it has a chance to be huge. So, again, going back to how preparedness helps you, if that happens and we do find ourselves in another recession or, heaven forbid, something worse, well, it would be awfully nice if I had a 2-week supply or a month supply of extra groceries on hand or something. So on that level, it makes sense. And as far as the reaction on an interpersonal level, situational awareness and your ability to defend yourself should there ever be a threat is a huge part of preparedness as well. Now, it's not my job to tell you how to do that. It's your job to assess your situation and decide what steps you want to take to be ready for that kind of situation. But to not acknowledge it as a threat post major events like this, I think, is short-sighted and dangerous. And when you spin that around to what's going on here in the United States, it's the same sort of thing. I don't necessarily need to repeat it, but you can see the exact same thing happen. And I'm not talking about the people running for office and their points of view and necessarily. I'm just saying that regardless of who wins the election, this election in the States is going to be fairly entertaining, I would imagine, if you're overseas watching it. And it is going to be highly charged, very emotional. And you just have to be ready, because when people are protesting and gathering in large groups the way they have been here in the States over the course of this year, and in some cases you've seen it already, there's always the opportunity for things to go sideways, and you need to be ready and have a plan for how to handle that. And that, to me, is just part of everyday preparedness. So I think the two things are very much linked.
Well, from my perspective, this side of the pond, as far as the U.S. election, the U.S. election is concerned, I see an outcome that, amongst other things, will serve up a sort of division along the lines that we've seen with the Brexit vote. That is to say, the people who vote for Hillary, if Trump ends up getting elected president, then the people who vote Hillary are not all going to go away. That is to say, the grievances are not going to go away, particularly those who are actually from the Sanders camp. Some of those will get absorbed into the Hillary camp, and all those millions of people that voted for Sanders, that is not going away. A lot of those people will not vote for Hillary, and they would rather jump into ravines, to use your earlier expression, than actually see Trump as president. Equally, Trump's supporters, some of them are extremely vocal, and he's had a polarizing effect even within the Republican movement. You see that, and there's a lot of Republicans who want nothing to do with Trump. I mean, look at how many Republican elected members of the party want nothing to do with Trump. But yet and all, he has these vociferous supporters, many of whom remind me in some ways of some of the Brexit voters. That is to say, they're siding with Trump, and they may well, if Trump becomes president, go, oh wow, it actually happened. So, to reiterate, I just see it as divisive. I see it a polarizing effect, and no matter who is president of the US, once the election is done and dusted, I don't see the country suddenly being unified around that president. Far from it.
I think you make a very astute observation there, and I'm not going to argue against any of the points you made. I believe that, again, the way... On a very macro level, directly to what you just said, if you step back just a little bit further, and I know that's hard to do when you talk in terms of a national election, but just a little insight into our party system, I really think if you were paying attention over the last few years, you know that we had the rise on the right of the Tea Party activists who were swept into office back in 2010. Ted Cruz, who was a presidential candidate, was one of those activists who came into power. And that minority of the larger Republican Party, in many ways, they were representing their constituents, make no doubt. But in many ways, simply because they were able to mobilize politically, they've been able to put the brakes on a lot of what has been tried to get accomplished by the president and, you know, the larger government as a whole. They've been able to really put a stop to that. And the Republican Party right now, I think, is going through the convulsions of what that means. Now that we're staring at a national election again, will that sell to the nation as a whole? And we'll find out soon enough. And on the other side, I would say that the Bernie supporters, and God love them because they are passionate and they have their beliefs, I really think we are seeing the beginning of what could become the left's version of the Tea Party on the right. I don't mean this in a bad way, but a more extreme position, further away from the center, right, than, say, your moderates, which generally what make they, those are the people that push government forward as far as actually being able to get something done because they're willing to compromise. But I really think that the Republican Party may be one cycle ahead of the Democrat Party as far as an uprising from the grassroots level and making sure their voice is heard. And it's been quite a spectacle. And going forward, I think we're going to see that continue. Now, I don't know exactly what that means for our political landscape as a whole, if that means we're going to become even more locked down than we have been. But I guess we will see. That's why we hold elections, you know, to my point about Brexit. If enough people come out and make their voice heard, then we will see where we go, and we may swing wildly in the other direction. So I just don't know. It's uncertain times for sure. And again, that's where I come back to, if it seems a little wild and you're feeling a little nauseous from the back and forth swing and all the high emotion, one thing you can do is look at your world and figure out how to better mitigate the impacts that these larger forces are gonna bring about, you know, by taking control of the things in your life that you can control.
Now, a short while ago, you mentioned just in passing the potential breakup of the EU. The reason I mention this is because one of the trends that I've been observing over recent years is kind of globalization in reverse. In most of my lifetime, the general macro political trends have been countries and organizations coalescing into ever bigger units, and it's from this basic idea that we got the idea of there would be a world government. Might it be the UN, a version of that, for example. The EU was held up by a lot of people as an example of this this tendency gone too far. In the States, when problems started to arise, in the United States in itself, as you mentioned, it's a continental country. It's a huge area. I mean, not really drawn under... I mean, the federal government is there, but the states vary so much in themselves and their character and in their laws and what have you.
Absolutely.
But we hear talk about the possibility that somewhere like Texas could secede. You know, you've got New Hampshire, what they're trying to do with their little freedom initiative, you know, because it's almost like they're so small they could maybe make a go of it. My point here is this reverse globalization, this idea of secession, I think that one of the trends of the future is going to be smaller units. And I think that has implications. And actually, I think a lot of positive potential. I mean, you could even, over here in the UK, you could even look at, prior to the Brexit thing, there was a Scottish independence referendum, which in the end didn't go the way of the Scottish nationalists. You know, Scotland voted to remain part of the UK. But the pressure is there, and the feeling is that this is not going to go away. So I don't know what your general feeling about the return of smaller units of government or economics or whatever it happens to be is, and whether you think that that holds potential. Sure, there are going to be downsides and it could be messy, the process, but whether you see it as more of a positive potential trend than negative.
Oh, absolutely. That is such a wonderful question, because it allows you to step back and look, and again, I've gotten my toes into the writing world a little bit, and I have several author friendships out there. My favorite genre is post-apocalyptic and dystopian, but oftentimes you start to look at what that world might look like. As a matter of fact, one of my upcoming guests, James Howard Kunstler, if you've read his World Made by Hand series, he lays out exactly what he thinks that might look like going forward. And I guess where I have to start with all this is, I think you're absolutely right. I think getting there, it will be messy. If that's where we're headed, I think it will be messy, and I think it will be painful. And I don't necessarily believe it's a bad thing. Actually, I think it would be a good thing on some levels, because again, it would give control back to the individual, right? Because then you would be forced to do things yourself, and I think that might just be good in the long run for a lot of different reasons. But it would also be a bad thing, because I would imagine that you would break up there's any number of lines you could break up along. You know, it could be regional, it could be the things economical that make a region viable. It could be climatic. You know, we may decide that it just doesn't make sense to live in the deserts of Arizona and Southern California anymore, and we move out of those regions. If you, again, to talk about another book, Stephen Conkley just wrote Fractured State, which is a wonderful book which takes a look at resource depletion and things like that. And we see that New Mexico, Arizona, Southern California, parts of Texas, become inhabitable in the not too distant future. And we are forced to make moves. But for me, I would step back even a little bit further and get to what I think is the crux of that and what made globalism possible in the first place. And now, I'm not taking a position of being an expert on this topic, but these are my thoughts on it. And I would say that you have to look at things that made it possible, which would be technological advances. And if you look at what make those possible, well, there's the economic piece, which allowed us to print money, you know, and grow the world economy based on the monetary system that we currently employ. But then there's the master resource, which would be our use of oil and carbon, you know, fossilized carbon-based fuels, which has allowed our economy and things like that to grow over the years and allows us in the United States to live the way we do on a continental country, stretched together by interstate highway systems and mass, you know, mass transit in the form of airplanes and things like that. So I think as we run into, again, taking a long-range viewpoint, as we run into issues with the master resource and our access to it and what it costs on the economic piece to bring it into our society and try to keep it functioning, when we run into issues with those things, I think that's where you're really going to see the wobble start to happen and things are going to get more and more loose and discombobulated. And I don't know if I could say that'll be 5 years or if it'll be 25 years before we hit that point. But I think if we don't change things, if we stay business as usual, I believe that that is not a future that is impossible. And when things really start to come apart and become strained, I think that's where you would see people segmenting off based on, again, it could be region, it could be climatic forces that cause us to move, it could be, I would like to believe that it would not be along racial lines, because America is such a melting pot country, and I believe in that completely. I think just by looking at our current state of politics, it may be that we would break up along racial lines. And I don't just mean black and white. I mean, when you look at Texas, for example, you have people who live in southern Texas now who, you know, they didn't cross the border to get here. The border crossed them. And now all of a sudden they're Americans, people who have lived in that region forever. I just don't know. It's such a huge question. I find it to be fascinating. I think I can see a future where it could happen. How exactly it would play out, I think, at this point, is best left to those who like to peer into the future and write those novels and give us their viewpoint, and we can see which one makes a whole lot of sense. But if you've heard me mention Stephen Conkley's got some good work like that, Kunstler has some good work like that. I'm actually working on a project whenever I can squeeze in a moment, to try to formulate what I think that would look like on a more solid kind of ground, but I think it's a fascinating question.
Yeah, well, I had Conster on here once, and I must do so again, actually, because I thoroughly enjoyed it. I like his, I like his perspective. Well, I say like is maybe the wrong word. I appreciate it. I think it's accurate. I think it's spot on, and I like his acerbic style. He's not interested in bullshitting, is he? He's straight to the point. So
right. Right, and it's one of the things that he's fond of saying, and I'm going to have to paraphrase just a little, but one of the things he's fond of saying is, history is tragic, the world is tragic. That doesn't mean things are bad, that things are, always going to end in a bad way. It just means that choices have consequences, and that the Earth doesn't really care. The greater planet and its forces don't really care what we have to say about it in so many ways. So we're going to end up there eventually. And in that long range point of view, what are you doing to get ready for that? Do you believe it's possible? That's a bet you have to make, that each of us have to make.
I'll just throw in a little thought here before I forget. You mentioned post-apocalyptic fiction being a genre that you enjoy. Once again, enjoy may be the wrong word, but I just recently picked up a copy of a new periodical anthology of post-apocalyptic or post-collapse fiction, perhaps we should call it, called Into the Ruins. And it was John Michael Greer who tipped me off about this. And I just sort of threw it out there to you and to the listeners that they might want to check it out. And I'm having the editor, actually, I can't remember his second name. His name's Joel, but I've been in contact with him and he's going to come on shortly. So I'm looking forward to that. But I just thought I'd throw that little factoid out there. But a lot of what you've been saying in the last segment, you've touched upon, how can I put it, an area that I get into a lot from many different angles, and regular listeners will know when I say the three E's, what I'm talking about is energy, economy, and environment, and these all interact in a million different ways with each other, all sorts of nexus points, and they are beyond the realm of, you know, art and the soul and philosophy and psychology and what have you. In the practical world of human affairs, these are the big impactful things that I think if you boil everything down. And of course, you talked about climate there. You mentioned at one point at the top of the hour. And that we can just read that as environment in a way. And these are kind of apolitical. Yes, human perspectives which inform our politics, of course they affect all of these things. They have a profound effect, and we could operate all of these areas very differently if we chose to, but the point is that they're having an effect because of the choices we have made. And in terms of preparedness, it's each one of these, the energy sector, you know, where we get our energy from, what the future looks like, the economic structures that we operate under, and the effect all this is having on the environment and how that affects our ability to survive and thrive. Any one of these, we could make a 10, 20, 100 part podcast series on. It's, you know, it's that big. So, and you can't look anywhere. I love the idea that you can go to a store, you can go out in almost to any part of town, anywhere in the sort of the, where the environment is predominantly human, and pick up any object and start to talk about it in terms of energy and economy and environment and see a problem with it.
Absolutely. I just have to say amen, Brother Greg, because the three E's are a bedrock formative principle behind everything we do. And many people have talked about it. I guess the person I listen to most often discuss it would be Chris Martinson and the work he does at peakprosperity.com, which is that's a place that I visit often. Hopefully I can have a conversation with Chris at some point in the future, so he can lay out exactly how he sees things. But I absolutely agree, 100%. And that is one of the baseline underlying goals for what I hope to get across in my conversations on the radio show, which, by the way, is called Practical Prepping Period, because we just want to keep it about the, as you said, the practical things that relate to our world today and why it makes sense to do things in your personal life, you know, to mitigate the impacts that may be coming as this system starts to wobble a little. But before I get too far into that, you also make points about the, you know, the spiritual side of life and art and the beauty that is all around us. And I absolutely believe that those things are just as important, because we often talk about having a holistic, holistic, W-H-O-L-E-I-S-T-I-C approach to preparedness. Meaning, yes, let's take care of the nuts and bolts stuff, but don't forget that we're still humans. You know, we still love, we still grieve, we still, you know, walk through this life, and, you need to be aware of those things too. You can't forget to live your life as you head down this road of preparedness, because it can be overwhelming, and there are a lot of very daunting ideas that are out there. But the way you work through that is to remain focused on your everyday life as well. So that's what we try to do anyway. And I appreciate your mention about Into the Ruins. I had seen it. I had not yet taken a good hard look at it. But of course, John Michael Greer is someone who I've listened to for a lot of years, and as someone who has been very influential in the way I see things, and that's someone else I would love to have a conversation with. So maybe I can make that happen too. But I appreciate you mentioning that.
Well, as a sort of a addendum to you talking about, you know, you got to live your life as you head down this road, beyond preparedness or, you know, skills or whatever it happens to be, there are now, yes, you can have your regular social networks, you know, and work networks, whatever it happens to be, but there's emerging networks of people who are interested in these topics, concerned about the same things, and you can get a lot of support and not just practical information, but just a lot of moral support and kind of and friendship and fellowship and the stuff that we're going to need going forward. And you can find that with like-minded folks, I think, at the minute. Certainly something that I would encourage people to do if they feel isolated or intimidated or about starting some of these changes in their life. You know, maybe their friends or family kind of think they're stupid or they laugh at them or think they're crazy or, and that response in itself can be very telling about the person who has that response. But, there are networks out there that we can plug into.
Absolutely, and I would like to invite anyone who's listening to, find us, find our website, find my Twitter handle, find our Facebook page, because I welcome all sorts of discussion, questions, just topics on things like we're discussing now. I do my very best to respond if I get an email or a tweet or a visit to the Facebook page. That is, again, I call it a business. It's a consulting business, but I mean, it's so small. It's more just like, it's sort of a community outreach, like I really just want to, if people are out there and they want to discuss these things, then consider me someone who is there to try to help you in any way I can, because, I think you're absolutely right. It can be overwhelming. It was overwhelming for me, at points. And I reached out to, just exactly like you said, people who were of a like mind. And that doesn't mean in an echo chamber. It simply means that they also see things that are going on, although they have their own individual take on it. And I trusted them to bring me back into focus about, okay, yes, this is going on now, but why are you interested in this process as a whole? And that brings you right back to what's important, and for some of us, it's just because we truly are fascinated by it. And for others, it's a familial motivation. You have to take care of your family or, whatever it is, whatever your reason. Again, I really don't care. Is when it comes to preparedness, I'm absolutely apolitical, and I just want us all to, do the best we can to get ready to take on, what I think there's a high probability that we will see.
Now, earlier on, you mentioned the book that you guys prepared, you and Steve, Practical Prepping, No Apocalypse Required. That was actually, I used that as a title for a show that we did together. People will find the link to that on this episode, this show page, I should say. Now, that goes into a lot more detail about things like storable foods, water supply. So if people are interested in that, they can, they can buy the book, they can listen to that. There's resources are everywhere. But I used the word skills in passing a moment ago, and this is something that maybe that you were alluding to earlier when you were talking about having specific themed shows that maybe you were going to do with your radio show, because there's that old saying, isn't there, if you give a man a fish, you can feed him, but you teach a man to fish, and he can feed himself. So an important part of preparedness, really, beyond just filling your larder or your garage or your basement or your loft with cans of food and pallets full of stuff from Costco, is maybe learning to do certain things that you will have for the rest of your life, whether it's learning to make clothes, to repair machines, to grow food. I mean, the list is endless, things that you can do. And if you only do one, you not only might find yourself in a position to help support yourself and your family, but, and this is another subject that comes up, particularly with some of the shows I've done with John Michael Greer, maybe in a more challenging economic environment, a more challenging employment situation going forward, that you could become a very useful member of a community when a lot of other people's pen-pushing jobs are going away.
Absolutely. And as we talked about during the off show, I recently have had a young baby girl. She is now 17 months old. And at this point in history, one of my goals going forward as she grows to be a beautiful young woman and into an adult is I want to make certain that she is equipped with very real, tangible, useful skills both because I think it's an enriching thing, you know, because if your education is strictly from a book in a classroom, then you may discover that you're not very educated at all. You need practical real-world skills in education as well. And as she grows, one of the things I will talk to her about is maybe she would want to consider a profession like midwifery, you know, because that's something that's never going to go away. Gardening skills, hunting skills, things like that, or craftsman skills, you know, a blacksmith, or pick a skill. You see where we're going with this. I think that's very sound advice. And when it comes to preparedness, I mean, you can really kind of parse it out into three areas. There's skills, there's stuff, and there's knowledge, you know. And I just think that part of the human experience, I am 40 years old, and I think, you know, I finished my grade school work, and then I finished college. I've been a professional now for 20 years. There's a lot that's behind me, but there's a lot of experience and knowledge and just wisdom of life that you garner going through that sort of stuff. But that doesn't mean that I've done it all. You know, I've learned it all. And that's part of the larger motivation for this project and virtually everything that I'm doing as far as this stuff is concerned. Because to your point exactly, you will never learn it all. And there's always someone else that knows more about any given topic than you do. And that's everything from a basic skill, like you were saying, learning how to garden or whatever, to just about how to navigate the stresses of life and the comfort that wisdom can bring you, and remembering that if we have more elder people in our lives, if we have elderly family members, grandparents and great-grandparents and things like that, that just because they're older doesn't mean that they are no longer valuable. The knowledge that those people possess, and the knowledge that I possess when I look at my nephews and our children of our friends who are quite young, I know things that can impact those people directly, that will help them to have a better life. I think we need to remember to value that sort of knowledge as well. I mean, but it's all about learning and growing, and I am hopeful that I have another 40 years in front of me to continue to do that. You know, that's part of our journey.
Well, I'm not the most practical guy that ever lived, and I was thinking maybe I might become a storyteller along the lines of, I don't know if you've seen the third in the series of Mad Max films, Beyond Thunderdome, but right at the end of that, it shows you some of the kids that were born after the apocalypse, after the collapse. And obviously there's no television, and there was never any television in their lives. But they sit in front of a busted TV, and the person, the storyteller, instead of having the television, they have what they call the tell. This person tells them how things used to be, and about planes and trains and automobiles and, you know, all the rest of it, and Walmart and... So I was thinking I might do that, you know, because then I don't have to get my hands dirty.
Well, you know, we're laughing, but make no mistake, that is a very real thing that will be necessary going forward if you dare to look into that kind of future. Because, I mean, and you see it in fiction works all along, whether it's Earth Abides, you know, with Ish telling stories to his great-great-grandchildren, as he gets on up in age after the collapse. And if you look at the movie The Postman, you know, the primary character in that movie makes his way around the barren landscape by entertaining, by putting on works of Shakespeare, you know, all you can decide with a donkey. I mean, you can decide how good a job you think he does, but that's how he gets his soup, you know, in a town. He'll put on a show and get his soup and make his way. So, and if you've never seen it, by the way, I highly suggest you watch The Postman with Kevin Costner. That is my favorite post-apocalyptic film. To your point, sorry, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but absolutely, there will be value for things like that. Of course, you know, if you know how to do anything else, well, now you're just, you're somebody that they can't let get away.
This is true, that because even in the Dark Ages and even right through to the early medieval period, there were guys who would make themselves invaluable. They might be quite physically weak or whatever, but they would quite snivelling characters, not always, but in some fictionalised accounts they were, but they made themselves invaluable to the local warlords or the king or whatever, and he kind of tolerated them because they were, you know, they were useful.
Yeah. I mean, singing, you know, bringing joy and merriment. If you can do those things, especially in a darker time, I think there's a place for that. But again, this is, and that's part of the reason, just on a personal level, that I'm not afraid to use the word enjoy this topic, because if you allow yourself to think into the future and what that world might look like, yes, there's going to be very dark and bad things out there, but there's also all of these sorts of things that I think can teach us lessons right now. The world doesn't have to end for us to value the elders in our community, you know, to put a priority on wisdom and knowledge. Those things are just as valuable today as they might be in some post-apocalyptic future, and we just often tend to forget about them because our world is the way it is. So I try not to do that. I would encourage other people to try to remember that those people are important as well.
I stumbled upon an article, just to take a slightly different turn, a few days ago, and I bookmarked it because I knew that we were going to be doing this, and it was ranking the individual U.S. states in terms of prepper numbers. Now, it's not...
I saw that.
Oh, you did. It's not completely scientific, but on the other hand, it's not completely unscientific. The guy who did it has used statistics that he was able to get his hands on. But I thought it was interesting because when I looked and found New Hampshire at the top, I wasn't actually surprised, and then I looked right at the bottom in terms of least preparedness, and it was California, actually in second from bottom is New York. Now, I don't know the US well enough to comment on all the rest, but the fact that I thought New Hampshire, yeah, of course, you know, makes sense, and then that New York and California would be at the bottom, it was kind of, yeah, of course.
Oh, well, on one hand, I agree with you, but I also would say that, you know, we should take that article with a dose of salt, a grain of salt, because there are plenty of people in California who are aware of, you know, an earthquake and things like that, and they have their earthquake preparedness together. And of course, in New York State, you have the winter weather and the occasional hurricane that makes its way up there, but... I was also shocked at first blush to look at that and find that it shook out that way, you know. But the sample size wasn't large. Like you said, it was really unscientific. So I could see both sides. I could make sense of how they wound up at that position. But then on the other side, like I said, I know that there are people who practice preparedness in those areas. But those are major metropolitan areas. And... I was speaking to someone who lives in LA, and they were telling me, well, people out here are just so thinking about the world today as it is right this second, somewhere to be, a big job to do, you know, and they just don't make time to consider preparedness. It is not on their radar. And that's one of the things that, I hope our approach, will help sort of break through. You know, meaning, yes, you can be a movie mogul and still take the idea that, you know, we're in the middle of a drought in California, there are wildfires all of the time, you could have an earthquake, you know, so maybe I should have a couple of weeks of stuff on hand just in case. It's probably not a bad idea.
There are a number of reasons why people would... you know, not take on board, not think about the idea of preparedness or potential disaster, despite all of the headlines that we keep getting, earthquakes, wildfires, hurricanes, all the rest of it. And then, of course, other threats, you know, such as terrorism, infrastructure, technology, cascading failures there. I mean, on and on and on. But
right.
There are different aspects of this which are interesting. One is... despite all of that evidence, as I say, people think there's still that it can't happen here, even to people for whom it has happened. You know, that there are, I watch coverage sometimes of, you know, wildfires, for example, in California, and people being affected by it, and it's kind of like, oh, it was so unexpected, or, you know, whatever it happens to be. And it's like, well, really? But again,
yes.
We don't live like that, thinking about these things. And then there's the wrapped up in cotton wool thing about government, you know, that the government will take care of everything. And this is despite repeated government failures that we, you know, we all know the big headline ones there. And then there's peer pressure, isn't there? Like I mentioned earlier, the sort of, so you've got what? You've got some stored food in your basement, like a you nuts type of thing, you know. So all sorts of reasons why people don't regard this and don't deal with it.
Cognitive dissonance is a powerful, powerful thing. And I've been doing research now for a few years, and I would love to be able to speak with them. But Dr. Nathan Hagans is someone who is taking a deep look at our genealogy, like just our history and why it is that we have a hard time identifying the very real threats that are in front of us until it is literally upon us. You know, he's taking a very scientific look at it, and I believe he's working on a book project or something along those lines, maybe as a co-author, that they're hoping to get out over the next few months. So I'll definitely be finding that one if I'm right on that assertion. So I think that's a very fascinating thing. And I think you're absolutely right. For someone like me who is just dead practical, and thankfully the people in my life are that way, my wife is that way, we can't look at those things and ignore them. You know, it's just like this, we have to do something. You see this, don't you? This is reality. And that is one of our basic motivations. But you're right, the cognitive dissonance is strong. It's much, much easier to not think about it, you know.
Yeah, on one level, I sometimes get the impression that some people think, well, if I was to somehow prepare for it, it might make it more likely to happen or something. That's just a deep psychological issue there. You know, it's like, why would I have a first aid kit in the bathroom? Because then I might just cut the end of my finger off, you know. But, oh, okay.
You're right, exactly. I hear what you're saying. I don't agree with it at all, of course, but I hear what you're saying. And I mean, you've mentioned something like terror, you know, and this speaks to the larger global wobble that we see. As things get more and more loose, you're going to see more instances like we've seen recently with terror, especially here in the States. And I have no interest in getting into a discussion about why or the philosophy behind it or anything else. I prefer to look at it as simply a fact. But prior to what we know as terror here in the States, terror has existed around the world, you know, forever. And even here in the States, as I was growing up, I was never one to look at a situation and be like, well, there's zero chance anything bad's going to happen. So I've always had this outlook. But as a prime example to our response to these real-world things that we see, just recently I took my basic first aid kit, which you might put in a sandwich baggie size with band-aids and things like that, that I kept in with my backpack every day that I carry with me. I took that and decided to upgrade it to a full trauma kit. And I posted a video on my YouTube page about it. If you're interested, you can find it there, and it walks you right through the things I chose to put in there and why and the philosophy behind it. But the root of it was, you just never know when something like this could happen. Again, I live in and around, or I'm in and around Atlanta here in the state of Georgia in the United States quite a bit. Atlanta was one of the first locations of terror that I have a really good memory of. And that was, of course, at the Olympic Park bombing 20 years ago, you know. So, I just think that by leveling up to this trauma kit, if I were to survive the initial attack, hopefully now I can become a good citizen and be in a position to help someone else that may be injured by applying a tourniquet or whatever it is that they need help with. You know, so it's about self, but it's also about the citizen. And I just... on a practical level, yes, that's something that will probably never impact me directly in my life. Could it? Yes. Will it? Most likely? No. So how do I justify that outlay of money for those resources? Well, I also have to drive a lot and commute, and it's at least once or twice a week I come upon a massive vehicle accident in my travels, and I was like, well, I'm on the road so much, if I were ever in an accident like this, or if I were to be a first responder coming up on an accident like this, I would have the stuff there with me and know how to use it. You know, I'm trained on everything that's in that kit to possibly save my life or the life of someone else until the medical professionals could get there. As you mentioned, and as I've mentioned, I now have a daughter. My wife travels with me. If we're in an accident and one of those two are hurt, of course I would want to have the ability to try to do something to help them. So for me, on a practical level and on a larger preparedness level, it made perfect sense. That is just one example of my actions that, you know, to try to address what I see in the world around me.
Well, what you've just said reminds me of a general point that's important to make or to remake, given that we already have to some extent. I mean, if we think back to the title of you and Steve's book, Practical Prepping, No Apocalypse Required, a lot of people have in mind that even if they think that, yeah, okay, well, laying in some food and some medical supplies and yada, 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 the usual, could be a good idea, but they still have at the back of their minds, you know, a hurricane, or if not the end of the world, maybe some kind of Red Dawn scenario where it's the end of the world as we know it, you know, whereas it can be a lot more mundane and localized than that. And I don't just mean localized as in, say, for example, you know, New Orleans or Sandy, for example, but
right,
an individual road accident people wouldn't often think of in the context of prepping, but it has an overlap. There's like a Venn diagram. I read stories from time to time, even here in the UK, where it's quite difficult to find wilderness. Every now and again, especially as winter draws in, I read stories about people just going missing when they're hiking on mountains, and they turn up a couple of weeks later frozen to death, and they were not far from civilization, but they just got lost and they weren't prepared, or if they were, they weren't prepared enough. You know, they didn't have backups for their mobile phones, or they were, you know, obviously out of reach of signal. But I've heard of people going on expeditions like this, not carrying enough water, not having suitable footwear, not taking waterproofs. I mean, all sorts of insane stuff that's totally basic. So there's all sorts of day-to-day situations that can seem quite mundane, but actually, if you're not prepared, they could turn out to be really unpleasant, and it doesn't need to be like that.
No, it doesn't at all. That's the thing about preparedness, and it brings me right back to our idea of living the lifestyle, which for us means, yes, it's stuff we do here at home. It's the way we think about our economic lives, you know, as we look into the future, savings and how we choose to spend our money and things like that. But every facet of our life, at least on some level, filters through the idea of preparedness. And for me, just my daily commute or travels filters right through that lens as well. And I said, this is a problem I should look at. And yes, terror might be the headline that flashes it in my brain, right, with these horrific images that you see. But on a very practical level, I still am addressing my personal needs. So if you took terror out of the world completely, then I still have a need for the things that I just invested my resources in. So I think that is and you mentioned earlier about people who aren't on board, and how do you combat that? How do you bring someone into it and make them understand that it's necessary, at least on some level? That is one way you can do it. All you have to do is just look at your world as it is, right? An honest view. And I just think it's very easy to find reasons to take steps to be prepared.
Well, just as we begin to draw things for a close today, Randy, in your experience with the work that you're doing in this area, are you sensing any increasing interest, increasing awareness? Because that's what we would like to see. You know, presumably it'd be tempting to, I don't know, to retreat away from informing other people if we weren't seeing this progress, but are you getting a sense that people are waking up to these issues somewhat?
I would say the answer is, at the same time, both yes and no. And quickly, I will explain. It's kind of like the ocean coming to the shore, right? You have a wave that crashes, and then it pulls back and another one crashes right over top of it, you know. And what I have seen is that absolutely there are people who, at maybe not in totality, are accepting the idea of preparedness, but you see a large movement of people who are more interested in getting off grid and becoming more resilient here in the United States, shrinking their consumerism. There are things like the tiny house movement here in the States that's become wildly popular over the last 2 years, where people just choose to scale their life down. And everybody, you know, in a continental country, we have a million, billion different viewpoints on why they want to get into it. So, yes, you have people who are becoming more aware and moving into it. But at the same time, I would say that I have noticed a bit of a lag or a falling back when it comes to the more extreme ideas, the caricature of preparedness. So shows like Doomsday Preppers and things like that, I'm not even certain that show's still on the air, you know, because those people laid out one vision of what preparedness had to be. But you also have shows that are wildly popular in the States these days, like Naked and Afraid or Alone, where people just venture out into the woods, and it's a reality-based show. But then they get out there and you see what they do to make it through their situations, you know. So, again, the spectrum is broad and varied, but also brilliant and rich, and there's a place for everybody to get in there. I just don't want people to be stigmatized by the labeling, you know. As you mentioned earlier, they don't want people to think they're odd. But I don't view it that way. I think it's wise and smart. And that's why I choose to look at it through the lens of a lifestyle rather than a come-and-go fad. So yes and no. I see it both ways.
Well, my closing thought would be that a lot of the Byzantine, Baroque aspects of the society that we live in, or certainly, you know, in the Western-style societies, you know, industrialized, relatively affluent, this is relatively recent. And I think back to somewhat to my father, but in particular to my grandfather. And if you'd zoomed in, could, you know, be a fly on the wall in his garage, in his workshop, could see that all the tools he had, all the skills he had, would absolutely put someone like me to shame. And he would qualify by today's standards, I think, as an advanced prepper. Supplies laid in because he'd lived through a couple of world wars. And all these skills that he didn't go to college to get, but he learned these things because he had no choice. If you want to do it, you learn it, if you see what I mean. So the situation we find ourselves in now, and this is, you know, John Michael Greer and James Howard Consular that we've mentioned during the show, they're very good on this. This is just a little blip. It's just that some of us have come to believe, because it's all we've known, that this has been almost forever and will be forever.
Hear, hear. My friends in the listening audience, Greg just nailed it. This is not the long-term situation for our civilizations. And I think when we come to terms with that, we have the right footing and the right starting point for why preparedness is a good idea. As I mentioned, I'm 40, so you can do the math and take it back. My parents lived in situations where you had holes in the floor of the house and you could see the chickens running beneath. You know, they came from not very much. My mother was one of eight, and they lived a very hand-to-mouth existence, sustenance living, you know. And my experience growing up was not that at all, and has gotten more posh the older I've gotten. But as I mentioned when we began this show, I grew up rural. And once I took hold of my adulthood, my wife and I, once we really took hold of it and decided what was important for us, it was important to get back to that rural life, much like what you just described, you know, where when you walk out back and look in our outbuildings, you see things that can actually do something for you. They have a purpose, you know, and this, we craft and develop the skills to make those things effective pieces of our resilience infrastructure, which is a phrase I love to use. And again, if you have any interest about stuff like that, go to my website. I've written about it there. You can see some of the stuff we do. But I I just wholeheartedly agree with you. And I would venture to say that your grandfather and I would get along very well.
100% sure of it. So you mentioned, Randy, your website. In closing, we've been talking about your radio show today. Share the details of that, your website, the practical tactical information, anything else that you want to put out there as a resource for listeners.
Okay, well, thank you for that. And the radio show, currently there's a page on Facebook. If you just search in your Facebook search window, you can search Practical Prepping Period and go to our page there to stay abreast of our upcoming guests and everything that's going on with us. Also on Facebook, you'll find a page for Practical Tactical, and you can keep up with various news stories, conversation, points of view, and things like that that I have going on. We are also on Twitter, and you can tweet us at PracTac, the number 4 and the letter U. We are also on Google Plus, YouTube, and my website is www.practicaltactical4you.com. The blog is deep and rich. There's a lot of resources there, videos, lists, information, access to the books. Even my Nation Makers initiative is on the website there. You can learn about that. So please, I hope you'll swing by and give it a look.
Splendid. Well, Randy, thanks once again for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Absolutely my pleasure, Greg. Thanks for having me.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.